America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Well, at what point is something surrender, and at what point is it real politic, and at what point is it pragmatic, and at what point does it actually work? How do we define these things? Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. John Bolton on the line with us. He's with the American Enterprise these days, former ambassador, United States ambassador to the United Nations, former guy down there in 2000 in Florida helping the Bush campaign, and many other things in between. His new book, Surrender is Not an Option, Defending America at the United Nations and Abroad. Ambassador Bolton, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
This book is a frankly fascinating insight into your life, or at least this dimension of it, this piece of it, and your thoughts on politics and your political perspective. When Colin Powell and Condi Rice were in your book, you talk about how they were talking about shifting U.S. policy in Iran and offering more carrots. And as I recall, after the meeting, you ordered carrot soup as a way of protest. You want to tell us that story very briefly?
Well, this was at a dinner that Secretary Rice had at the Aquarel restaurant at the Watergate Hotel to celebrate, I suppose, the announcement she was going to make the next day that the United States was actually prepared to sit down and negotiate with Iran if it would give up its uranium enrichment activities. This, even though Iran remains the world's central banker of terrorism, and we've said we won't negotiate with terrorists. So there people were all in a very celebratory mood. I didn't feel so good about it. I ate the carrot soup. Only Bob Joseph got the joke. But, really, it reflected a policy that had failed for years before that and has failed for years since then. Iran continues to pursue nuclear weapons, and because of these years of failed diplomacy, our options for dealing with that problem are now quite limited.
Now, during the Cold War, we had the Soviet Union, which actually had nuclear weapons, which actually had declared hostile intent towards us, which it had actually backed proxy wars against us in a number of countries, including Vietnam. And yet we talked with them. We negotiated with them. We even signed treaties with them. Why should we be so different in our negotiations with basically a third-rate third-world country, as opposed to how we dealt with the Soviet Union?
Well, the difference in power between Iran and the Soviet Union, of course, is important, but even the possibility that Iran could get nuclear weapons leaves them with the decision when and under what circumstances they would use those weapons. And in a very ironic way, this asymmetric relationship actually gives them proportionately a lot more leverage, and leverage over our friends and allies in the region.
But the Soviets are doing the same thing by backing all these proxy wars. And frankly, I mean, you go back to the McCarthy hearings. I mean, they were convinced that the Soviets were had cells and infiltrated the United States, and perhaps to some extent had, actually. I mean,
Well, the difference, I think, in Cold War terms, looking at the respective nuclear arsenals, was that we did have a kind of parallel calculus in Moscow and Washington over the consequences of an unconstrained nuclear
mutually assured destruction
between the two of us, and it would have been civilizational destruction. In the case of Iran, you have a theocracy that believes that life in the hereafter is more desirable than life today. And in the most extreme case, the 9/11 suicide attackers, obviously these are not people capable of being deterred by the prospect of retaliation.
There are also people who had nothing to do with Iran.
Well, no, look, the fact is there are a variety of different kinds of Islamic extremism, and that much of what impels the activity against coalition forces in Iraq today is being financed, equipped, and trained by the Iranians. The disparity here
is also, though, being equipped by and financed by the Saudis. I mean, they're doing fundraisers. In fact, according to the Department of Defense, more than half of the foreign fighters who have been caught inside Iraq are from Saudi Arabia. Fewer than 5% are from Iran. Most of the funding that they've been able to identify is coming from Saudi Arabia.
Well,
if
you're
in favor of threaten first and negotiate later, why don't we start threatening Saudi Arabia?
You know, if you listen to our military commanders who face the threat on the ground every day, for several months now, they have been saying that the shaped explosive devices, the various military threats they actually face, are coming predominantly from Iran. And General Petraeus, our commander in Iraq, just said a few weeks ago that the Iranian ambassador in Baghdad is a member of Iran's Al-Quds Force, the overseas element, the foreign element of their Revolutionary Guard. So you can imagine if the Iranian ambassador in Baghdad is a member of the Al-Quds Force, you can imagine what's going on inside that so-called embassy there.
But isn't that sort of like condemning Colin Powell for having been a member of the U.S. military?
I think you're, you know, really, I must say, the notion that you would put an active member of the Al-Quds Force in charge of your mission in Baghdad tells you a lot about what Iran's real objectives in Iraq are. And that's why the threat that Iran poses is one that grows far more acute as they get closer to operational nuclear weapons. The Iranians are not going to be talked out of these weapons. They see this as a trump card, and that's why more than four years of failed European diplomacy has left us with precious few options to prevent them from acquiring the weaponization capability.
Well, we're talking with former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton. His new book, Surrender is Not an Option, Defending America at the United Nations and Abroad. The McClatchy News Service yesterday, despite President Bush's claim that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons, experts in and out of government say there's no conclusive evidence of this. Even his own administration appears divided. Bush's point man on Iran, Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns, has attempted to ratchet down the rhetoric. He says, quote, Iran is seeking nuclear capability that some people fear might lead to nuclear weapons capability, but I don't think anyone right now thinks they're working on a bomb.
Well, you know, one of the reasons I left the administration was the mistaken policy we were pursuing with respect to Iran, led by Nick Burns. Secretary Powell, in December of 2004, held a press conference in Brazil where he talked about the steps that Iran was taking to weaponize the possible nuclear capability that they were seeking. This isn't dreaming. It is a view that people in places like the Russian Atomic Energy Agency, who know what a nuclear weapons program looks like, are very, very concerned about. There's simply no explanation for what Iran is doing other than the pursuit of nuclear weapons. I'll give you one example from documents that they inadvertently produced showing they have plans as to how to fabricate uranium metal or plutonium metal into hollow hemispheres. The only known use for that is to put two such hollow hemispheres together to form the core of a nuclear weapon.
Right, as we all learned in high school.
Let me just finish here. The plans that they turned over showed how to fabricate this, and these kinds of plans have nothing whatever to do with civil nuclear power. That's what Iran's strategic objective is.
And you think they're the only country in the world that's looking at how to make a nuclear bomb?
No, I don't think so at all.
Let me just take it to the larger issue here.
Can I just finish the answer?
Certainly.
You know, the point is that many other countries are watching how we deal with Iran. And if the Iranians succeed in getting a nuclear weapons capability, other nations will conclude that they can and should do so themselves.
But we already did this with Pakistan and with India.
The stakes are very high here, and we are now today seeing the consequences of the proliferation that Russia in India and China in Pakistan engaged in years ago.
John, I'm sorry, we have about a minute and a half left. And I just wanted to, John, we're talking with John Bolton. His new book, Surrender is Not an Option. John Kennedy spoke. He basically said, you know, we're not afraid. His famous...
The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
And yet it seems that throughout your book, and Franklin Roosevelt made similar comments, and Eisenhower made similar comments for that matter, it seems that throughout your book, everything is being driven by fear and threat. Why that instead of diplomacy and standing tall as we historically have done in the world?
Well, you know, I think the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, Dan Gillerman, summed up this question of Iran about as well as anybody had, and did it in a very level-headed fashion. He said, in President Ahmadinejad, you have somebody who denies the existence of the original Holocaust while preparing for the second one.
But see, that's true. That's also true of the leadership of Saudi Arabia. It's probably true of the leadership of three quarters of all the countries in the Middle East.
And as I said, other countries are watching how we deal with Iran. Just in the last year, approximately a dozen Middle Eastern countries have said they too want civil nuclear power programs. This is why the entire
that could be because of peak oil.
It could be because the risk of the proliferation, the nuclear non-proliferation treaty breaking down as people see what happens when countries like Iran violate it, get away with it, and nobody does anything effective to stop them.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting conversation. John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Surrender is Not an Option is his book, Defending America at the United Nations and Abroad. Ambassador Bolton, thank you so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
You know, for a long time, this nation did not profess fear. I seriously consider that for a moment. In my book, Cracking the Code, this really hit me last night as I was doing a riff, you know, a book signing, giving a speech at a book signing event. And we were talking about future pacing, the concept of if you can throw somebody into the future, if you can have them imagine a future, particularly repeatedly, and imagine it in an acceptable or even positive light, then it becomes much easier for them to accept whether that future is a war with Iraq, whether that future is a war with Iran, and that's what's being drummed up, or whether that future is a nation at peace. And we have had diplomats and we have had presidents and we have had statesmen and women in the past who have held high the ideals of peace and who have held high the ideals of we're all humans here. We're all in this together. And then you have the conservative worldview that says, oh, no, there's evil people. That's the intrinsic nature of people. And you just can't negotiate with them. You can't work it out with them. This was the argument that was made for the suppression of the Irish immigrants in the United States in the early 19th century, for the suppression of Italian immigrants in the later 19th century, for the suppression of African Americans for 400 years, for the oppression of women. Oh, it was all Eve's fault, you know, for seven millennia. John Kennedy, though, future-paced us in a completely different way. He talked about a completely different future.
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
And therefore, indiscriminately bombed or, you know, but we're seeing this incredible run up to war. Increasingly, and as you're watching it, you're watching the dollar collapse, you're watching the price of oil go through the roof, you're watching the price of gold go through the roof. Since George Bush came into office, the dollar has lost a third of its value. Why might that be? Well, perhaps because Ronald Reagan borrowed trillions and trillions of dollars and now we have to pay it back. You know, 20-year treasuries start coming due. Reagan borrowed the money 26 years, starting really in a big way 24 years ago when Reaganomics wasn't working. So you have to pay off these debts, so you pay them off with dollars that are worth a third as much. Not bad. Governments have been doing it forever, except for the fact that it destroys our country. And then, you know, we're confronted with the need for the ongoing need for oil as a consequence of the absolute and utter failure of the Reagan administration to continue the policies put into place by Jimmy Carter of making us independent of oil. And so what are we doing? We're all hysterical about any country that has oil. Iran is the sixth. No, I'm sorry. Pakistan is the sixth largest nation in the world in terms of population. And in Pakistan, we have one of the greatest threats right now. And General Pervez Musharraf, I mean, this is pretty amazing. From today's Financial Times, Mr. Musharraf justified the emergency by referring to the growing threat from radical Islam and the need to enhance the effectiveness of Pakistan's law enforcement agencies hobbled by judicial interference. Musharraf is out there talking about judicial activism. This is all about Musharraf versus the Supreme Court. So here we have the country that has, I believe, the second largest Muslim population in the world behind Indonesia, Pakistan. They have the nuclear bomb. Their government is going down in flames. It's a terrible mess. The U.S. is dithering. We're freaking out, trying to figure out how to deal with this thing. Osama bin Laden is living in their country. They have openly the Taliban and Al-Qaeda operating. Our policies and Musharraf's policies there are feeding it. And we're running around saying, it's time to bomb Iran. I don't get it. I would so like to see us as a nation return to the ideals that we once held, to the way we thought of ourselves relative to the world. Franklin Roosevelt, for example.
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
And yet at the same time, yesterday it was reported that, or perhaps it was the day before yesterday, it was in my stack, I didn't get to it, that the deal between Iraq and Russia for what may be the fifth or sixth largest oil field in the world and arguably one of the most profitable oil fields in the world, larger than the entire Alaskan North Slope, in Iraq, an undeveloped oil field, Russia had cut that deal with Saddam Hussein. The Iraqi government just canceled it. American oil companies are lining up, as are other of our ally oil companies. Putin is seething. Greenspan is right. It's a war for oil. Arguably the second largest supplier in the world in Iraq. Iran, third or fourth. But we've got to bomb them. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby.
34 minutes past the hour. Now we're not going to back down, I'm telling you. By the way, this Friday, what is that, 3 days hence? 4 days, whatever it is. This Friday, November 9th, I will be in Phoenix. We're doing a gig at the Hawkins Theater. It's Arizona Mills in Tempe. You have to have tickets for this. You can get them at the website of our Phoenix affiliate, KPHX. Their website is 1480kphx.com. In Philadelphia, and I just noticed much of this is not on our website. Unfortunately, I'll try to get that updated later today. But in Philadelphia on Monday, I'll be at the White Dog Cafe, 6 o'clock dinner, 7:30 doing Cracking the Code. That's on Sansom Street in Philly. On Tuesday, the November 13th, 7 p.m., the Strand Bookstore in New York City. And that's on Broadway. On Wednesday, November 14th, I'm speaking at Demos. And on the 16th, on Friday, in San Francisco, we'll be at the Little Fox Theater in Redwood City from 3:30 to 6 p.m. Information on that at quakeradio.com. 9:35, Tom Hartman here with you. I just want to play one again. The way that America used to view itself, we have historically had leaders who were not themselves terrified little men. I don't know how else to say it. In my mind, I envisioned George W. Bush in his mind as a terrified little man. And I think that Dick Cheney is too, and they've surrounded themselves by terrified little men. And I remember when we did not have, and maybe a few terrified little women as well, but when we were not ruled by terror and those who were terrorized. When we said things like, when presidents of the United States said things like confident and unafraid. Listen.
We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task, or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
Amen. 1-866-303-2270, a number. Henry in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Henry, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm enjoying your show. I just wanted to respond to what Ambassador Bolton was saying about, wanting to attack Iran. It just seems that you were just saying about the little men. It seems like it's becoming us against them in every facet of the right-wing machine. He wants to...
Right down to kids who need health care.
They want to have a war. They want this war no matter what. It's like they're stamping their feet like little children.
Yeah.
And Iran is not really that big of a threat to us. What's going on in this country is the threat. You have Pakistan, doing the things using the methods that George Bush really has put in place.
That's right. The biggest, as we talked with Naomi Wolf yesterday, the biggest threat to the United States right now is coming from within the United States, and it's coming from the Republican Party, frankly. It's coming out of the White House and their enablers in the Republican Party, and the Democrats in the Democratic Party who go along with it, who go ahead and vote for these bozos and put them into office, I mean, like this Mukasey nomination, the Republican-like Democrats and the Republicans. It's just, where are the American patriots? Where are the people in the United States? Where are the politicians in the United States who are willing to say...
Or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid.
Confident and unafraid. What happened to that in our vocabulary? Hope on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. Hey, Hope, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I appreciate you always reminding us with those audio clips from the past, reminding us of who we are. I also wanted to comment on the John Bolton. He just regurgitates neocon talking points ad nauseum. This right-wing propaganda, it's begun to take its toll in the American psyche. Zogby's latest poll, 52% of Americans would support a strike on Iran?
That's right. This is in NLP or psychology, it's referred to as future pacing. You create a future in people's minds, you make it acceptable, and then when that future becomes present, they're not so flipped out about it. And, that's what they're doing.
He's disseminating fear-based lies about Iran. And it's not only disingenuous, but it's highly dangerous.
Yeah, I don't disagree, although even if they're not lies, they're A, fear-based, and B, irrational. You want to worry about something, we should, if we want to, we should be worrying about the loss of freedom here in the United States, the loss of the Constitution of the United States, the evisceration of human rights, the destruction of our reputation around the world. And if you want to worry about a military threat, take a look at Vladimir Putin with 8,000 or 9,000 nuclear weapons, which are still pointed at us. Take a look at the fact that the Chinese, the Financial Times this morning is reporting, it was much ballyhooed yesterday, the Chinese finally, after years of the United States asking them, will you please put in a hotline so that if there is a confrontation between the United States and China militarily, we can pick up the phone? And the Chinese now today are saying, yeah, sure, we'll do that someday. We're not even going to talk to you about when, though. If somebody wants to ratchet up the fear card, there's plenty of stuff out there that we could be, neurotic about. The fact of the matter is we should be able to deal with it all the way that we have throughout the history of this United States for the last 230 plus years, which is appropriate diplomacy, negotiations, confident and unafraid. Hope, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate your comments. Philip in San Diego, listening on KLSD. Hey, Philip.
Good morning, Tom. I think one of the reasons that people aren't getting the message again about, like we should do stuff like we did in the past just because they're not getting the message here in America. For instance, a lot of people probably don't know that Pakistan and, India and Israel have nuclear weapons already. They didn't sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And yet they're our greatest allies. Even Bush just said in response to what's happening in Pakistan that, he should stop that and have elections, but they're still our good ally on the war on terror.
Yeah.
It's all ridiculous.
Well, Musharraf has the kind of government that Bush wished he had. He said, things would be a whole lot easier if this was a dictatorship so long as I'm the dictator. So, well said, Philip. Thank you very much. Chris and Eugene, hey, listening on KOPT. What's up, Chris?
Yeah, about Mr. Bolton, the same thing about the talking points. It always bugs me when they say, you know, Iran is the worst sponsor of terrorism, but I never hear any details. They just keep throwing that out there.
Well, I'll give you the details. Iran is known and has been known for a long time to be a major sponsor of Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is arguably a significant terrorist organization. Here's where it gets tough, though. Hezbollah, the reason that they've been able to build a strong base, for example, in southern Lebanon, is because they're running hospitals, they're running schools. I mean, you have Fatah, you know, Yasser Arafat's group that now we're all saying, and the Israelis are saying, okay, we can deal with these people, we can negotiate with them. They've kind of come around. They were terrorists at one time. You know, they start providing for their people. I mean, you know, Menachem Begin blew up the King David Hotel. We were terrorists against the British. It's like, you know,
yeah, exactly.
There are very few countries in the world, frankly, that have come into being good countries, you know, and I include us and Israel in that category, that have come into being without some level of asymmetrical warfare in the beginning or protest
exactly,
or whatever.
Exactly, so they're just throwing it out there.
That's right. I was starting to say purely rhetorical. It's largely rhetorical. Good point. Thank you, Chris, very much. Lila, is it Lila or Lila, right, in Falana Beach?
Yeah, it's Lila, actually.
Lila, thank you.
Tom, thank you so much for your program. I just to answer you, like you were saying that where are the people? That was kind of my point because I live in a little beach town, and honestly, if I start talking about Pakistan or trying to get people to understand what's going on, they look at me like I'm wearing a tinfoil hat. I mean, it's just nobody cares. And I tell them to listen to your program, you know, just to learn something, because I'm from Iran. And it's not really a, I don't know if they're trying to just delay this whole process by, you know, they have a year to kill, so maybe let's just talk about Iran a lot without doing anything. Because honestly, if Iran were to be attacked, I can tell you for sure that even though the Iranians, for the most part, are very pro-American, they would not be pro-American after that, and there'd be a lot of trouble.
And we had, you know, we had Norman, pardon my interrupting you, Lila, but we had Norman Podheretz on this program, an advisor to Giuliani's campaign now, one of the major neocons, one of the major hawks, and he said if we attacked Iran, it would create a wave of anti-American hatred around the world, and that's a desirable outcome in his mind. That's a desirable outcome in the minds of these guys.
Know that how many Iranians are actually very, very productive members of American society. I mean, the huge corporations are owned by Iranians. They're in NASA. They're all over the place. You don't want that kind of hatred.
Well, not only that, over 70% of Iranians in Iran say that they're in favor of America. They hold American values.
Yeah, but they wouldn't be after that. But,
you're
you know,
right.
Again, I just don't understand how you can get people to pay attention other than maybe, you know, reinstate a draft to make them wake up, because nobody around me seems to care. And it's so frustrating because when I listen to you, I feel sane. And all day long, I feel insane after that.
Yeah, well, thank you, Lila. I appreciate your kind comments. We do have to be waking people up. I mean, there's just no way around it. And economic issues are one way, you know, those things, but war and peace, another way. Lila, thank you so much for your call and for listening to the program. Well, all I can say is we have to keep talking about it. And I'm telling you, as I'm traveling around the country on this book tour, I am seeing the biggest crowds I've ever seen, ever. And the most animated and passionate people. I'm very optimistic, frankly.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Next. I just can't seem to figure it out.
Bomb, 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 bomberan. Bomb, 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 bomberan. Bomb, 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 bomberan.
Went to Iraq, caught up the black. No turning back to war with them. Let's just attack and bomb Iran. Bomb, bomb, bomb.
Yeah, that's their song. That's the conservative song these days. We need they believe that they need another war in order to keep us distracted from the destruction of the American economy. and you know, everything else that they're taking apart the New Deal. Hey, the only way you can distract people from such things is to whip them up into a nationalist fervor by having another war. Wouldn't it be a fine thing? Strange things on the wires these days. This, as we say, from the wire service. In what he described as an emergency mission to help a key ally in the war on terror, President George W. Bush flew to Islamabad today to give General Pervez Musharraf tips on how to eliminate democracy. Mr. Bush said he scheduled the trip just hours after General Musharraf declared a state of emergency in Pakistan and suspended elections, quote, because when it comes to eliminating democracy, I think my friend Pervez could benefit from my experience, end quote. Speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One, Mr. Bush said that while he commended General Musharraf's impulse to eliminate democratic institutions, he felt that the military strongman was going about it the wrong way. As Bush said, when you're getting rid of democracy, the last thing you want to do is tell people you're doing it. Mr. Bush said that eliminating such things as privacy, freedom of speech, and the Constitution has to be done very quietly and stealth-like. As he said, if I had gone on TV one day and just ended democracy like Pervez did, I would have caught holy hell for Maureen Dowd. You've got to be crafty about these things. Mr. Bush chalked up Mr. Musharraf's decision to disclose the elimination of democracy as a beginner's mistake, adding, I've had six-plus years of practice at this. He also criticized the Pakistani dictator's firing of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Trust me, he said, if you're going to get rid of elections, a Supreme Court can come in handy. From not the wire service, but from our friend Andy Borowitz, with permission from the Borowitz Report, borowitzreport.com. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tom in Longmont, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Tom, what's up?
I just wanted to bring up the contradiction about Bolton not recognizing the fact that we sold arms to Iran back in Iran-Contra, but we don't negotiate with terrorists. I guess we just sell arms to them.
Right, and that was back when he was part of the Reagan administration, which
yes,
is where he
exactly.
opens his book. Yeah, good point, Tom. Thank you very much. Greg in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just called likewise to point out a problem with Bolton's argument. He said that the rest of the world is watching how we're dealing with Iran and somehow by bombing, implying that by bombing or invading them, that will deter the rest of them from pursuing weapons programs or
right.
nuclear weapons programs. Well, weren't all these countries, including Iran, also watching how we dealt with Iraq?
Exactly. And that's why Kim Jong-il was just quick as a bunny to develop his own nuke, because he see, you know, oh, axis of evil, and you bomb the axis of evil that doesn't have nukes? Okay, we got a nuke. Absolutely right, Greg. Absolutely right. We need, once again, in America, statesmen and women who are willing to stand up and speak the historic American ideal from the Monroe Doctrine, from George Washington's farewell address to today. Well, until the coup of 2000. When an unelected president became president as a consequence of three buddies on the Supreme Court, actually five, but three of them having members of their family working on his campaign. But let us remember.
I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task.
Well said. Joyce in Long Island. Hey, Joyce, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I greatly admire your amazing knowledge of American history, and I heard you play some words of Franklin Roosevelt a few minutes ago. I'm
yes.
a retired history teacher,
mm-hmm.
and I was born in 1929 and grew up during the Depression, during very hard circumstances,
mm-hmm.
and Roosevelt had a great impact on my life. I grew up in rural Maine. My mother was practically penniless in 1933, and I remember the first year of the New Deal when Roosevelt was giving out the dole. My mother took me by the hand to the local office and got a few dollars that managed to get us through. Mm-hmm. Then later in 1936, I was fortunate enough to hear Roosevelt come to a town in my home state of Maine, where he was on his way to Campobello. He got out on the platform of the train and gave a very inspiring speech. I was only 7 years old.
Mm.
And I think that it had such a profound impact on me, believe it or not, that I later wanted to teach history. So, you know, I did. I worked my way through college and graduate school and taught school 36 years.
God bless you.
That's great. So I whenever I hear you refer to Roosevelt and your great admiration for the New Deal,
mm-hmm.
and your fear that it's being eroded, you know, I find your words very inspirational.
Well, thank you, Joyce. And here for you, Franklin Roosevelt, once again, it's just a 15-second clip, but it is so important that we hear this over and over again.
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
Joyce, thanks so much for the call. It's very nice to hear from you. You're welcome. Tom in Golden, Colorado. Hey, Tom, just a few seconds before we got to wrap up this hour.
Hey there. Hi there, Tom. You're fantastic. I wish you were on TV.
Well, I'm having fun on radio. What's up, Tom?
More people see it. I just saw Henry Kissinger's expose, and it's clear that that man committed an amazing amount of war crimes.
Are you talking about the movie The Trials of Henry Kissinger?
Yes.
That is something that should be in every history class in America. You're absolutely right. I don't want to say ever since Kissinger came into power in the Nixon administration until today, we've had a series of criminal administrations, as I suspect you were about to suggest. But Kissinger certainly has played his role, and really, it's more his worldview. Coming up next, are you ready to pay $8 a gallon for gas?
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's tough love time, my friends. We really need to have in the United States a serious discussion about this. We might as well start it on this program. And I tell you, the Republicans actually, in some bizarre fashion, I suppose you could argue, started it some time back. Here, I've got this email from May 23rd of 2006 from Ken Melman. The Larry Craig, I guess, of the GOP leadership. Ken Melman, who was the chairman of the Republican National Committee, sent out this email before the elections of 2006. He says, President Bush is focused on providing practical solutions to energy prices. The headline is, you know, is about how the Democrats are going to, well, here's the headline. The Democrat plan, $3.73 gas. Now, keep in mind, this isn't from the 2006 election. This is from 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago. He says, you plan your summer road trip, you've had to budget for rising prices at the pump. President Bush is focused on providing practical solutions for energy prices. However, the Democrat plan is going to cost you more. Their agenda of higher taxes and more red tape would mean higher gas prices for you and your family. The average family would pay $955 a year more. Yeah. Okay. So here's the tough love. Are you willing to pay an additional $5 to $10 a gallon to tax on a gallon of gasoline in order to prevent war and chaos? Because that is rapidly what it is coming down to. You know, I'm quite serious in this, and I realize that you know, a lot of my listeners make their living driving, and we certainly need to figure out a way that people like long-haul truckers who are independents, for example, can get back that tax or not pay that tax or something like that over the short term so that people's livelihoods are not wiped out. People have to commute long distances and things. We need to make a rapid transition to mass transit. But the bottom line is that the real cost of a gallon of gasoline right now is probably somewhere in the neighborhood, the actual real cost probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $15. There's about $2 in a gallon of gasoline that is the cost of cancer and diseases nationwide as a consequence of burning a dirty fuel, gas, as opposed to a clean fuel like ethanol or biodiesel. There's about $3 in a gallon of gasoline, and depending on how you calculate it, it might be as high as $5 in a gallon of gasoline for the cost of the military protection and transportation of that oil all around the world, and protection of our oil resources like Iraq and the Middle East, supporting dictators around the world. There's arguably a couple of other bucks on that gallon of gasoline that are the cost of the way that we're conducting ourselves in the world relative to other countries that are not specifically military, but have to do with our basic addiction to oil. I mean, Jimmy Carter laid all this stuff out. It's real. You know, the oil crisis, as Carter said, you know, he said, this is real. It's not going away. It's here and now. And this was back in 1978 that he was saying this. So here now, we're looking at studies. We're finding, for example, 1,400 scientists, this is the UN Environmental Program, found that human consumption had far outstripped, this is from The Guardian, had far outstripped available resources. Each person on Earth now requires a third more land to supply his or her needs than the planet can supply. As a consequence, biodiversity is being wiped out. 30% of amphibians are seriously threatened by human activities. 23% of mammals, 12% of birds are under threat of extinction. 10 of the world's largest rivers run dry every year before they reach the sea. Irreversible damage to the climate. And again, most of this tracks back to this explosion of economic activity and what we call civilization, whatever you want to call it, that is driven by oil. And there's increasing evidence that we've hit peak oil this year. The largest evidence of that is that oil is pushing $94, $95 a barrel, and it's not just because they're expecting a war with Iran. Oil traders, I mean, it's incredible. Oil futures are, the article on the front page, I'm not sure if it was the front page, I cut it out, it might have been on the third page. Anyway, today's London, Financial Times of London, the headline, scramble to insure against further oil price rises. And what they're talking about is how people who would trade in oil contract futures, in other words, they're betting on future prices, it's exploding. Javier Blas in London reporting in the Financial Times. Energy consumers and speculators are scrambling to take out option contracts to insure themselves against oil prices rising above $100 a barrel. The buying frenzy has been extraordinarily strong in the past week. Option calls of strikes well over $100 a barrel are being bought by the thousands. The open interest at $120, $160, and even $250 a barrel is rising. People are buying calls right now. There's a graph in here of call options on oil at over $100 a barrel, all the way up to $250 a barrel. And they're looking at the, you know, thousands of calls being bought on a daily basis. And you go back to May, and it was like, you know, it was around 2,000 to 2,000 calls. And then in the middle of 2007, it got up to around 7,000 calls. And then about 2 weeks ago, it hit 15,000 calls a day. And then these calls are bets that the price of oil will go above $100, and in many cases above $200. And again, what I would submit to you is that we've been paying this all along. The problem is that instead of paying for all of these costs of oil, the cancer costs, the military costs, the foreign policy costs, the failure to do things domestically that would be cleaner and have less terrible dramatic impact on the planet costs, that the consequence of all that we've been paying this all along, we're just paying it through our regular income taxes. What if we were to say, as the countries of Europe did 20 years ago or more, actually it had to be longer than that, because I lived in Europe 86, 87, which was exactly 20 years ago, and gasoline at that time that I was living in Germany was $5 a gallon, and $4.40 of it, as I recall, was taxes. So what if we were to say, as the Europeans did way back then, way back maybe 30 years ago, I'm not sure when they started slapping these really high taxes on gasoline, that we're going to pay for the war in Iraq, since, as Alan Greenspan says, it's an oil war, and we're going to pay for whatever we do in Iran, and we're going to pay for supporting oil dictatorships around the world, Nigeria and whatnot. We're going to pay for that by taxing oil. And if you ride a bike to work, if you live in a city like Portland, like I do here, where you can ride a bike pretty much anywhere, there's a great mass transit system. If you live in a place, you know, where it has been forward-looking, or if you help create one, that you don't have to pay for this. And if you live in a place where the city leadership has been so blind that even when Jimmy Carter came out and said, you know, this is absolutely real, and we've got to do something about it, if you live in a place like that, then, you know, you're going to pick up more of the cost. Pardon me. Just hit my mic button there. And so if we added $5 to $10 in tax to every gallon of oil, what would happen to every gallon of gasoline, excuse me, what would happen? What would be the consequence of that? You know, obviously, again, there would be terrible economic dislocation, and it would whack the middle class and working people really, really hard. And we have to figure out a way to get around that. I mean, it's just, you know, very straightforward on that. That said, much of America, it would start changing their habits very quickly, as people have all across Europe. I mean, this is over a 30-year period. The average European consumes one-seventh as much gasoline as the average American.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
That was Jimmy Carter, July 15th, 1979. When he left office, we lost our national energy policy, and we haven't had one since. Dick Cheney was put in charge of the Energy Task Force by George W. Bush and the Counterterrorism Task Force, the only two jobs he had when he became vice president. Counterterrorism Task Force never met until September of 2001. The Energy Task Force only met with the oil executives and maybe Arnold Schwarzenegger. We don't have an energy policy. We have a billionaire policy. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
There's no business like oil business, like no business I know. And everything about it is so thrilling.
No business like the oil business.
Get that happy feeling like when you're drilling that Arctic well. There are no people like oil people. They smile when it does so. Withholding technology, they know it's all. OPEC strains a hold on the oil. They only care that their earnings do not fall, so their profits will grow.
Ah, yes, so their profits will grow. 21 minutes past the hour. Let us remember again, July 15th, 1979, we could have avoided this entire mess.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
And instead, we have terrified little men running around telling us that we need to bomb Iran because they have so much oil, you know. We can't allow them to get nuclear weapons. Heavens no. And increasingly, the evidence, the United States hit peak oil in 1974. And Carter acknowledged it and said, okay, that's it. We've gone from being an oil exporting nation to an oil importing nation in a decade. And we're not going to import any more oil. Reagan came in on oil money, major contributors to his campaign, and scrapped Carter's energy policy, scrapped it, took the solar panels down off the roof of the White House, shut down the tax credits for what was then a burgeoning beginning industry. I remember when Louise and I first moved to Vermont, we traveled around the state looking for a house to buy, and in Vermont, which is in the north and where it's cold, we kept finding all these solar homes and homes off the grid. I mean, you know, it's a kind of rural state. It's a wonderful state, actually. We love the 10 years we lived there. And all of them were built, and we probably saw, I don't know, 8 or 10 of them out of maybe 30, 40 houses that we looked at when we were trying to find a place to live back in 96 when we moved to Vermont from Atlanta, or 95, whatever year it was. All of them were built in this two-year period of 1978, 79, early 1980, maybe three-year period, because Jimmy Carter had put into place these tax incentives to build passive solar houses. Those houses are still there, and they're still generating electricity. They're still generating heat from the sun. There's still windmills. There's some hydro. There was one house that we saw that was hydropower. It's all there. 1 gallon of gasoline takes 13.5 pounds of crude oil, which started out as 196,000 pounds of prehistoric plant matter. We're running out of prehistoric plant matter. We're spending $5 a gallon, more or less, on the cost of the military, and it's frankly, I think it's probably twice that when you consider the cost of caring for disabled vets, and you consider all the costs that are going down the road from the invasion of Iraq to the occupation of Iraq, the invasion of Afghanistan, so Hamid Karzai, the old Unocal executive, could have his pipeline across the country. We're paying for it. You and I are paying for it. Working people are paying for it with our taxes, our income taxes. We're paying it for it with fees. We're not paying for it directly. I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong. And I know, I can tell you right now, I guarantee you, no Democratic candidate is going to join me in this because it would be political suicide. But somebody has to say it. The real cost of gasoline in the United States right now, not the cost of ethanol or biodiesel, the cost of gasoline right now in the United States is at least $10 a gallon and probably $15 a gallon. And we're paying most of that, not at the pump, but to the IRS. You've got this huge bloated military budget, largely to protect our oil supply because of absolutely nutso policies being pursued over the years by Republican administrations. And you know, frankly, Bill Clinton didn't do that much about this either. I mean, he had an opportunity. He could have done what Jimmy Carter did and didn't. A tragic failure of leadership. And so here we are with gasoline that really and truly is costing $10 to $15 a gallon. At some point, Americans must wake up, as Europeans did 30 years ago, and say, you know, this stuff is really a lot more expensive than, you know, with all these subsidies and everything else than we're trying to make it out to be. Let's actually pay the real cost of it and raise the price of gasoline at the pump to $10 to $15 a gallon right now and say, this is what it really is. You want the war in Iraq? $15 a gallon at the pump. You want a war in Iran? $20 a gallon at the pump. You want to support other oil dictatorships? You want to continue relationships with Saudi Arabia? You want to continue exploiting Nigeria? $22 at the pump. I mean, let's pay the real cost of this at the real place where it's being used. Or am I just totally off the wall on this? I frankly don't think I do. I am. I mean, basically, here's the choice. War, chaos, and higher income taxes on the one hand, and massive U.S. debt and a wiping out of the value of the U.S. currency. We've seen it drop by 30% since Bush became president on the one hand, or $10 to $15 a gallon gas at the pump. What's your choice? 866-303-2270, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Okay, tough love time for oil and war. Are you willing to pay an additional $5 a gallon for your gasoline? Or would you rather pay that, because you're going to pay it one way or the other, in war, chaos, income taxes, and environmental destruction. Your choice. Which is it? Ryan in Coopersburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind today?
Well, I'd like to share a couple of things with you that are my concerns and also what my wife and I have done to try to lower our energy consumption as far as oil is concerned. Number one, the thing that concerns me the most is I'm a small-time contractor, and I run my business out of a pickup truck, and I have a trailer that I bring to every job site, and the truck that's capable of pulling my trailer only gets about 12 miles to the gallon. So I agree with what you're saying wholeheartedly about pay for it one way or another, but what scares me to death is if we see gas prices even at $7 a gallon, it's basically you sunk my battleship as far as my business is concerned.
Yeah, I understand your point, and I suspect that probably a large number of people in the United States would be in that same position. And economies tend to recalibrate themselves fairly quickly. What would happen, you know, obviously, is that the cost of a whole lot of things is going to go up. I mean, we're seeing this right now. The article in today's Financial Times about how the U.S. airlines are all starting to jack up their fares because they've seen their fuel costs go up 30% over the last 6 months. And as a consequence of that, you know, you may have to charge more for your services. I'm curious, and then that passes down the line. If there's a corresponding reduction in income taxes because we're not paying for an insane military, then we've got, you know, something different. I mean, you'd get that money back in some other way. But I'm curious, what percentage of your total revenue in the course of a month do you pay out for gasoline? In other words, if you look at your entire income, you know, your entire income versus the cost of gasoline.
Yeah. I live in Pennsylvania, and I work in New Jersey because that's where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
That's the clientele that can afford my services.
Right.
Now, I have found that I tend to price right on the line of almost not getting the job because I'm too high of a cost for them, but I go through, on average, close to $200 a week in fuel. So almost, you know, $800 to $900 a month out of my profit is a fuel cost.
Right. Now, if you don't mind my asking, what's your gross revenue in the course of a month? Gross income before you've paid your expenses and things.
Before I pay my expenses? It depends on the job that I'm on, but around $20,000.
Okay, so what you're talking about is about 4% of your total cost.
That's right.
And if you were to double the cost of that gasoline, it would become about 7 or 8% of your total cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that would mean that you would have to increase the cost of the service that you're providing to your customers by 3 or 4%. Do you think that would really make you non-competitive if everybody else was in the same boat and had to do the same thing?
It depends on if the other contractors don't behave in a cutthroat manner, which I've seen in the past.
I mean, if they're in the same boat you are, what's
No, that's a valid point. That's a valid point. I just seeing from what I've experienced in the, you know, estimating jobs and 10 years ago, if you were told you were competing against one other person in a bid, that was a rare occurrence. Now when I get to a customer's or a potential client's house, I'm saying that, you know, they're telling me that I'm the third or the fourth guy that has been to the house.
No, I get that. But, you know, Ryan, you and I have both, you know, run small businesses. And I suspect that you know as well as I do that most people make their decisions on a whole lot of variables beyond just price. In fact, very few people actually ultimately make their decision based on price. They make it on quality. They make it on the nature of the relationship that they have with the person, whether or not they trust the person. They make it on word-of-mouth references. One of the, you know, most powerful forms of advertising. And my guess is if your prices had to go up 3% and you just said, hey, I'm worth it, and this is just the cost of fuel, that we had a business way back in the 70s. We were selling herbal teas, and we had one product in particular where our cost went up slightly. It had ginseng in it. We raised the cost of that product we were selling everything else for $2.85 per ounce, as I recall, and we'd raised this one to $3.25 and expected to see our sales fall. Our sales on that product, not dollar volume, but unit sales, our sales on that product went up about 10% in the first 6 months because people looked at it and said, oh, it's a little more expensive. It must be the better quality one.
Interesting.
So
And then on a level of our personal house, I know that I've gone, well, my wife and I, we've replaced all the windows in our home. We own an old farmhouse that was built in 1871. We've gone along and replaced all of the windows for more energy efficient models, and we've made an investment of over $7,000 for two, high-end, extremely efficient wood stoves that burn on about an 85% efficiency rating, and our oil consumption over the course of the winter is only about 100 gallons.
That's great. Good on you, Ryan. I mean, the bottom line is these are the kind of transitions we all need to be making. And that $7,000 you spent, there should be some tax credit in there for you. And the money that you spent on your windows, there should be tax credit in there for you. And there would be if we still had Jimmy Carter's policies. And if the price of gasoline goes up and you have to raise the cost or your expenses to do business, your expense to do business goes up 3 or 4%. At the same time, we should be saying, okay, and your taxes, the taxes that you're paying as a corporation or as a sub-S corporation are going to go down 3 or 4%. Because you don't have to pay for that percentage of the military, because we're no longer having to have all these guys in Iraq, and so it washes out. Anyhow, Ryan, I got to move along, but thank you for a very a thoughtful conversation on this. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Tom. I just think we just belong to Osama bin Laden right now, because he wanted oil to be $100 a barrel, and that's what we've got. And he wanted our military out of Saudi Arabia, and that's what he got. And he didn't like Saddam Hussein, and he got that too. And you know what? I don't think he likes Iran very much, and that's all I've got to say. Thanks.
Yeah, no, you're well said, Karen, and you're right. He doesn't like Iran because Iran is a Shia nation, and Iran will not tolerate al-Qaeda. And Osama bin Laden would like nothing better than for us to bomb Iran. And Osama wanted us to bomb Iraq. And Osama wanted us to have George Bush and these cons as president so that we would gin up a policy that would turn him into an international hero rather than an international pariah, which is, frankly, in my opinion, what would have happened had the Gore administration, which actually won the election of 2000, taken power. But instead we had the coup of 2000, and we needed to start calling it that. And we've got now King George III and Lord Cheney. And I realize my rhetoric is starting to get a little off the edge, but that's what I'm seeing. I'm sorry. Emery in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Emery.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not exactly right to just say 3 or 4% increase in costs, because you have employees, you have lunch costs, you have supplies. All of those things get 3 or 4%. And in the end, you're talking really about 20 or 30% of an increase.
Well, my guess would be you're absolutely right. My guess would be you'd probably be looking at more like a 12 to 15% overall cost. But it's one that everybody's going to be hit with.
Right. Well, with the exception of people that already own properties.
Keep in mind, Emery, when Bush came into office, gasoline was around $1.25 a gallon. It's now $3 a gallon. And,
right.
And you know, we haven't seen, I mean, it's hurting some people clearly because there is no policy in place to deal with it. There is no, hey, if you become more energy efficient, or if you buy a more efficient, car or truck, or if you move over to some alternative fuel, we'll give you a tax break, or we'll give you, I mean, they give tax breaks, of course, to oil companies and to nuclear power industry, but not to the average person. But
right.
So we've seen a virtual tripling of the cost of gasoline since the Republicans took the White House in 2000 or 2001, and it hasn't caused this wild dislocation. I don't think that this would, frankly. I think that it would cause a reorganization, a recalibration.
Yeah.
But if we did it smart, we could do it in a way that would not hurt average working people, I believe.
You know what the sad thing is that, you know, while we're sitting here debating the backside of the possibilities of which way to go with gasoline, you know, I mean, I studied advanced technologies all the way dating back to the 70s, and, you know, we've been lied to about things like hydrogen oxygen engines, which are water-run engines.
That's
we've
right.
been lied to about magnetic rotors. We've been lied to about a lot of things. I mean, you could sit there and say, yeah, corn only produces 1.2% for the energy put into it coming out of it, but hemp produces 8 to 1, and we don't, and we've made that illegal on a consumption value, whereas alcohol kills 450,000 people more a year than hemp has killed in the history of hemp, you know. But I mean, we've been lied to across the board about all of this stuff. I mean, the gas companies, the plastic companies have been lying to us about advanced technology since the 50s. I mean, the first engines were run off of ethanol. Yeah. You know, Ford built his cars
yeah.
with ethanol.
Yeah, the original Model A. You're absolutely right. And excellent points, Emery, and thank you for making them. Janet in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Janet.
Yes, for your listeners, go to oilendgame.org, and there's an excellent analysis of the real cost of oil and four possible solutions to solve the problem. I don't think it makes any sense to pass this on to the consumer. If we subsidize oil companies for $65
billion, my point is, Janet, the consumer's already paying it. We are paying with our income taxes.
No.
We're paying for the cost of the military, and with our Medicare taxes, we're paying for the cost of all the diseases that are caused by the use of gasoline. We're already paying it.
Let me finish, okay? What we're doing is we're subsidizing oil companies $65 billion a year to drill on public land.
Right.
Take that money away, give it to alternative fuels and fostering the new businesses.
Spot on. Tell us again what that website was.
Oilendgame.org.
Oilendgame.org. Thank you very much, Janet.
Thank you.
Many thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. What is it? $15 a gallon gasoline or war, chaos, and ever higher taxes in other areas? 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Ain't no surplus now, it's gone. Oh, the debt grows every day. Yes, the balance of our loans is bigger than Star Jones. Tell the kids they'll have to pay. I don't know what I'm gonna do. I wish this debt would go away. I could try to pay these bills, or sell Dick Cheney's pills, or put Congress on eBay. And
we owe so much. I'm telling you, $9 trillion debt, and most of it run up by Reagan and Bush. That's absolutely incredible. By the way, just a quick heads up. This Friday, I'll be in Phoenix. We'll be doing our show live from KPHX. And that afternoon at the Harkins Theater at Arizona Mills in Tempe, I'll be doing a speech on my new book, Cracking the Code, and also a book signing. Tickets are required. 1480kphx.com is the website for our affiliate in Phoenix, and that's where the tickets are available. On the 12th, Monday night, I'll be at the White Dog Cafe in Philadelphia at 6 p.m. For dinner, and at 7:30 to be talking about cracking the code. That's on Sansom Street in Philadelphia. On November 13th, on Tuesday, at 7 p.m., I'll be at the Strand Bookstore in New York City. And C-SPAN will be there as well. Drop by. That should be great fun. 7 o'clock, 7 p.m. on Tuesday. And Wednesday, Demos is sponsoring a talk by me on cracking the code. That's in New York City. That's at 5:30. And then on November 16th is Friday. It's going to be a long week next week. On Friday next week, Green 960 AM in San Francisco. Green960.com, their website. The Little Fox Theater in Redwood City, 3:30 to 6 p.m., and should be a hoot. You know, be there, be square, as they say. But anyhow, green960.com. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the Mukasey nomination, as you know, went through by those two votes. Would not have made it without Mr. Schumer, would not have made it without Feinstein. And Mukasey was, this is the scary Halloween fright, even though we've just passed Halloween. Dana Perino, just at the White House podium, said that he would be a critical member of the national security team.
Well, that in and of itself should tell us that we don't want this guy there. I'd rather, frankly, have a constitution than have an attorney general. That's the choice right now, I think.
Well, it's not a pretty picture, to say the least.
If I may interrupt, back during the Nixon administration, when Nixon was trying to get through his, as I recall, third, maybe fourth attorney general, he had to cut a deal with Congress and say, okay, I will give you a special prosecutor if you'll give me an attorney general. Why can't the Democrats in Congress say to the Bush administration, if you want us to vote for this Mukasey guy, throw in a special prosecutor who's independent of him, who can look into the crimes of the Bush administration, and we'll give him to you?
because they're spineless.
Yeah.
How's that?
I guess I knew that before I asked. I'm sorry.
There's a lot of talk about Musharraf and the fact that the president has not called Musharraf. He's relying on Condoleezza Rice to do so. Asked just a few minutes ago whether he was a dictator, the White House spokesperson Dana Perino said it's premature to say that. She again pushed the fact that they want to see a democracy, again pushed on the fact that the president hasn't picked up the phone. She said, well, we're working with the ambassador there, completely avoiding the fact that the president, in fact, is not talking directly to Musharraf. All Dana would say is that they have a good relationship and that we're working together on the war on terror. No discussion also about whether, in fact, they are going to try and deal with some of the aid that they get. And again, that's $11 billion in aid since 2001 that's on the books, I remind people. We don't know what's off the books in that sort of black budget that we now may be up to $50 billion a year.
Right, of military money that we're handing over to him. And, you know, please find Osama bin Laden for us, please, but don't look very hard.
Another thing that came up, Michael Levitt, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services, put together this study about how we can have our food safe, and he worked with several agencies. Just a scary fact, which I didn't ever know about, there are over 300 entryways, ports, et cetera, into the United States. 300.
And none of them are safe right now.
Well, I asked him the question. I said, what about the fact, is it terrorism versus food, and how do you combine the two? And he said, well, it's basically a new world, and we're going to try and combine the two.
Yeah, but the simple
thing. And then I asked about money, and he said, well, we haven't budgeted anything. This is going to have to go through the regular budgeting process.
I mean, if an unscrupulous corporation can smuggle poisoned food into the United States, what makes you think that an unscrupulous terrorist can't smuggle an atomic weapon into the United States if we've got all these ports that are absolutely open and unprotected?
300 of them. The president today then also, on the heels of all this, called for Congress to pass trade agreements, in particular around Peru, and then he said he wants to go with Colombia and Panama, and he said, well, it's not fair to pick out one country and not support the trade agreement with the other two in our hemisphere.
Right. We need to be able to exploit everybody.
Right. And apparently the National Council of Manufacturers is very excited about these trade agreements.
Oh, absolutely. Cheap labor everywhere. We can shut down more American factories. We can move more American manufacturing offshore. You can bust up more unions. I mean, the National Association of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce, they have to be just salivating. Absolutely salivating.
Well, he certainly is pushing pretty hard on that. And, of course, I don't think we would get a whole lot different from a Clinton administration or maybe any Democrat at this point.
Yeah. Well, this is why.
One other last amazing thing that I don't know if you already know about. It's just the best news I've ever heard. But the Sunlight Foundation is now working with Google Earth, and they have put a map on the web that allows people to take a 3D view of where all the earmarks are in the defense bill.
Oh, how cool. That's great. Do you have a website for that?
I think you could go to Sunlight Foundation or Google Earth, but Sunlight Foundation would probably do it.
Yeah, that's great. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks so much, Ellen. Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Welcome back to our third hour, 6 minutes past the hour. Laura Flanders with us, the host of Radio Nation on Air America Radio, the author of Blue Grit and Bush Women. She's contributed to a new book, Contenders, Hillary, John, Al, Dennis, Barack. One of the best, finest voices in progressive talk radio as well. I just want to add, I'm a great fan of Laura Flanders. And Laura, honored to have you on the program.
Oh, Master Tom, I am so happy to be with you. What fun. It's been too long.
Indeed, it has been. And I, you know, one of these days we've got to get together and And have some have a conversation about what's
now,
going on.
Now, when is that
going
to be again? The fun day?
Yeah, right.
When we celebrate all our progressive victories and all the hard-won victories we've fought.
One can hope. Laura, I've read this book. The book is called The Contenders, and you and Richard Goldstein and Dean Coopers and James Ridgway and Ellie Sanders and Dan Savage and others have contributed to it. And the chapter that you contributed to it is about Hillary Clinton. And I read this last week, actually. And my sense of it was that you were very ambivalent. Do you want to share with me your thoughts on Hillary Clinton as a candidate?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I mean, I believe she is picking up baggage every time she opens her mouth about Iran, about the use of force, or prevaricates, as she did in that MSNBC debate on a key issue like immigration. She is gathering baggage as she goes, and I'm worried that it will just sink her come next year. But on the other hand, here is a candidate who, you know, has the ability to mobilize a base on the basis of being a woman that is speaking to a lot of women in the Democratic base who have been waiting for a candidate to pay attention to them for years. So, you know, my ambivalence is that, you know me, I believe in blue grit. I'm interested in which candidate is cultivating which forces on the ground, building what kind of leadership. And here's a candidate who, while I and many of her supporters disagree with her on just about every important issue, and not just in principle, because I think it'll land in her defeat. Nonetheless, is speaking to a large component of the Democratic base that hasn't been spoken to in years, and she may just get away with the nomination because she's doing that.
Yeah, I have, you know, my preferences in this program are pretty transparent. I think Chris Dodd on the issues is great. I think Dennis Kucinich on the issues is great. I think John Edwards is frankly the guy that the Republicans are most afraid of.
I think that's right.
Just like Ed Muskie was the guy that Nixon was most afraid of, and so he set out to take down Muskie. Just like, frankly, Howard Dean was the guy that the Republicans were most afraid of in 2004, and which is why he was the only candidate that they spent $1 million in Iowa with a Volvo driving, latte drinking ads, the Club for Growth ran, to take down Howard Dean. And that all said, you know, that would, and I, in fact, I've contributed money to the Edwards campaign. That all said, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee of the Democratic Party, I would vote for her and I would work for her because hope springs eternal. I really believe, you know, I look back and I see that Franklin Roosevelt, somebody sent me a copy of, Saturday Evening Post from, just weeks before the election of 1932. And there was a front page story and a long article by his vice presidential candidate basically laying out his platform. And 90% of what Roosevelt was running on was recalibrating Smoot-Hawley. It was this really wonky discussion about exactly how our tariff position should be with the rest of the world. There's nothing in there about the New Deal. Now, you know, he ran as a moderate, far more moderate than Hillary Clinton, frankly.
Well, that's right, but he had Eleanor in his ear.
And he transformed America once he got into power. You can say the same thing about Teddy Roosevelt.
I don't know whether I believe it about Hillary Clinton. I'm not sure people have great, you know, new births on their path to the White House. I think that one of the things that we're getting in the way of coverage of Hillary Clinton is this kind of commentary that suggests that all the positions we don't like, progressives don't like, that she takes, it's just politicking. You know, she's just trying to compensate for being a woman on the campaign trail. I don't think so. When it comes to the use of force, the advocacy of military force after 9/11, the advocacy of military force back during the bombardment of Serbia. She was right there. She was calling for bombing when even the generals in that case were saying to Bill Clinton, you know, you should send in ground troops because what you may lose in U.S. forces' lives, you will save in the lives of people on the ground. And that's exactly what happened. Aerial bombardment led to the massive escalation of ethnic cleansing on the ground. She was the one saying bomb, bomb, bomb. It's not like there is only politicking going on. I think this is who she is. So when you say I'm ambivalent, I'm not ambivalent where I stand on Hillary Clinton. I'm ambivalent about whether she deserves to win because, frankly, she is doing an extraordinary job of organizing. We on the left have really
failed to put up a force that can beat her, and that rolling bulldozer that's her husband and our ex-president and their money-making capacity, we've got a big problem. We are, I think, about to nominate a candidate who doesn't stand with the majority of her voters on the key issues of our day, namely how to respond to the threats this nation faces.
We're talking with Laura Flanders. She's a contributor to the new book, The Contenders. Her website, lauraflanders.com. She's also the host of Radio Nation on Air America Radio. Laura, yes on everything you said. I understand and agree. And at the same time, it seems to me that, and I think, frankly, this is an echo of what I said earlier, that the Republicans, the person that they're most afraid of running against is John Edwards. And therefore, they would love to run against Hillary, and they would love to run against Barack Obama. And so all we're hearing in the media is Hillary and Barack Obama.
Yep.
And yesterday, Chris Matthews was throwing out the new Republican, you know, slapdown phrase. It was Slick Willie back in the 90s, and now it's Slippery Hill. And he had it up on the screen, in fact. And then he was quoting this betting site in Ireland that was pointing out that over 70% of the betting is that Hillary Clinton will get the Democratic nomination. Only 47% believes that she can beat any Republican candidate. In other words, the professional bettors are saying, yes, she's going to get the nomination, and that's going to cause the Democrats to lose in 2008.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You're pointing to a very important thing, which is the role of the media in all this. And I was so struck in that MSNBC debate out of Pennsylvania, out of Philadelphia last week, that the, Tim Russert did his best imitation of an anchor from Fox News. And there were so many right-wing talking points being thrown around, from her electability to real ID to the terror threat of Iran's nucs, that it felt like a Republican debate. It was like the Democrats had, been dressed up a day ahead of Halloween.
And 14 of his 30 questions were either to or about Hillary Clinton.
Well, you know they don't really want any of those other candidates in the contest.
So, if that's the case, and again, I think that both of us, correct me if I'm wrong, both of us are saying that if Hillary Clinton is the nominee of the Democratic Party, then what we need to do is make her president and then do everything we can to mobilize the grassroots to move her in a more progressive direction.
Well, I'm up for the mobilizing the grassroots. I don't believe it's my job to try to make her president. But,
well, I mean, vote for her.
Well, I think there's no question this country wants change. The reason that I object to the way her campaign is being presented in the media is that really nobody else is being given a chance. And you're right, this is going to saddle a Democratic Party with a leader that doesn't mobilize the base by virtue of her position. So you're right, there'll be people like us out there trying to get people engaged in a process when, let's face it, most people will be frustrated, disappointed. I'm already hearing from people who say, wait a minute, what did they think the 06 election was about?
Oh, yeah, I know. And that's what, that's what's coming down the road as well. But I also, we have a long history in the United States of politicians being elected on one thing and doing another thing, not because they had an epiphany, not because their fundamental character changed, but because they heard the will of the people. You had Lyndon Johnson was a right-wing racist cracker from Texas who passed the most sweeping civil rights legislation of the century and cut poverty in half in a 4-year period with the war on poverty. That was not the result of Lyndon Johnson waking up the middle of the night. That was the
right. But Tom, at that period, and that was the same in the period of FDR that you talk about when you talk about the New Deal, there were mobilized grassroots movements on the left, not inside the party, but
that's
to the
work
left of the party providing a threat.
Right, and that's the work we have to do. And you have, MoveOn.org has millions of members, and Democracy for America. I mean, there's a number of groups that are growing. It's just, anyway.
But do we pose a threat? That's the question.
Yeah. So the bottom.
Where's our hammer?
Indeed. So the bottom line, ambivalence, but we'll keep on plugging.
Keep trying to build that hammer.
There you go. Laura Flanders. The book is The Contenders. Laura's website, lauraflanders.com, host of Radio Nation on Air America Radio, author of Blue Grit and Bushwomen. And these are also two excellent books that I highly recommend. Laura, thanks so much for being with us
today.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Did you get us?
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Miss Monica. I miss Monica. I miss Monica. I miss Monica. GW's twisted logic is kind of hard to follow. It's almost pathological and all its promises sound hollow. And the lies he tells would be hard to swallow. Even for Monica, dear sweet Monica, with a cute beret and her pouting lip, she made the most of her internship and learned back then loose lips sank ships. And the scariest thing in the news was a picture of Linda Tripp. I miss Monica.
Wouldn't we all love to return to a time when we didn't have, as Keith Olbermann says, a criminal conspiracy, a criminal enterprise in the White House. As my old friend Mike Malloy calls it, the Bush crime family. It's amazing. Well, Dennis Kucinich, on the floor of the House about 25 minutes ago, did it. He started out reading the international law, basically, the treaties that we have signed, in particular the United Nations treaties, and U.S. law, and documenting how Dick Cheney had violated that law. Dick Cheney, excuse me, the way he actually pronounces it. He rather likes the fact that most of us don't know how to pronounce his name. And Dick Cheney, Kucinich calling for his impeachment. Here he is on the floor of the House of Representatives just 20 minutes ago.
The purposes of the United Nations, unquote, the threat of force is illegal. C, Article 51 lays out the only exception. Quote, nothing in the present charter shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations until the Security Council has taken measures necessary to maintain international peace and security, unquote.
In other words, you can't threaten people that you're going to attack them, and you can't attack them unless you've been attacked first. That's the treaty we signed with the UN.
Iran has not attacked the United States. Therefore, any threat against Iran by the United States is illegal. The Vice President's deception upon the citizens and the Congress of the United States that enabled the failed United States invasion of Iraq forcibly altered the rules of diplomacy, such that the Vice President's recent belligerent actions towards Iran are destabilizing and counterproductive to the national security of the United States.
You tell him, Dennis.
In all of this, Vice President Richard B. Cheney has acted in a manner contrary to his trust as Vice President and subversive of constitutional government to the prejudice of the cause of law and justice and the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, Richard B. Cheney, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office. Mr. Speaker, this resolution is similar to a resolution which I introduced earlier this year and has the support of 22 of my colleagues in the House.
And then in response to this, Jose Serrano, the Democrat from New York, who was acting as the speaker, the acting speaker of the House, basically said, okay, fine, we will consider this. We're not going to shut it down right. At least this is my understanding of what he said. We're not going to shut this thing down, but we're also not going to put it out. So here's his exact words.
Under Rule 9, a resolution offered from the floor by a member other than the majority leader or the minority leader, as a question of the privileges of the House as immediate precedence only at a time designated by the chair within two legislative days after the resolution is properly noticed. Pending that designation, the form of the resolution noticed by the gentleman from Ohio will appear in the record at this point.
Now, if I'm understanding this correctly, and I may not be, and if I'm not, you know, give us a call and let me know. We'll take your calls right after the break. But my understanding is that basically what Congressman Serrano just said is Nancy Pelosi has 48 hours to figure out whether or not she's going to take this thing, she's going to allow this to come to the floor for a vote. He wrapped it up.
The chair will not at this point determine whether the resolution constitutes a question of privilege. That determination will be made at the time designated for consideration of the resolution.
In other words, by the rules, by the Speaker of the House, which would be Nancy Pelosi within the next 48 hours. So if you'd like to let your member of Congress know your thoughts on the impeachment of Richard Cheney, the toll-free number, the best collection of toll-free numbers that I've been able to come up with, is on a page over on our website that we got a URL to point to called callcongress.org. You'll go to www.callcongress.org, and there are all the phone numbers. And they all lead to the same place, which is the White House switchboard, or the Capitol Hill switchboard. And when you get the operator at the Capitol Hill switchboard, say, I'd like to speak to, in my case, I'd say, I'd like to speak to Congresswoman Darlene Hooley. She's my representative, my member of the House of Representatives. Don't call your senators. I mean, you can, but this is not before the Senate. This is before the House of Representatives. You may also want to call Nancy Pelosi's office. And again, you can reach the exact same way. Call the switchboard and say, I'd like to speak with the Speaker's office, please. Be very respectful. Be very short and concise. Because I guarantee you, they're getting a zillion calls right now. But contact your member of the House of Representatives and let them know how you think about this. Callcongress.org will get you all the phone numbers, all the toll-free numbers that I know of, as well as the main number, which is 202-225-3121. Our number, 1-866-303-2270. Our website, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And AirAmerica.com for our blog. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
6 6 3 0 3 22 70. Yes, that's what you got to remember. They got the guns, but we've got the numbers. 34 minutes past the hour. Come on, my friends! 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jeremy in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Jeremy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? I wanted to address Hillary Clinton, and, you know, when I see your polls that come out, you know, you do these straw polls, they stand completely contrary to what the media tells us.
Yeah.
When Hillary's supposedly winning by such a huge majority, it makes me wonder, you know, what's really going on. And I don't know if there's anything they want more than some Trojan horse than Hillary Clinton, who basically would pass every neoconservative agenda that they could ever want. Not only do they want to run against her, I don't think they'd mind having her in office.
Well, it may be, Jeremy. I'm not ready to go that far. I really, number one, I'm not going to demonize Hillary Clinton. And number two, I really don't believe that she's that bad. I just don't think she's as good as some of the other candidates. That said, if you go to journalism.org, and a tip of the hat to Invisible Man who passed this along to me, if you go to journalism.org, which is, you know, a basic one of the main journalism websites out there, they have a statistical correlation between the amount of media coverage candidates get, regardless of position or party, Republican, Democratic, whatever it may be, and the amount of money they've raised. The more money they've raised, the more media coverage they get. Why? Because the media know that money's going to end up back in their pockets. Bottom line, the White House is for sale.
Well, you can't really pin cause or effect on that, and I just think that it's like Bill Clinton. He passed NAFTA under the He passed NAFTA, which was a Reagan and Bush agenda all along.
Yep.
You know, and nobody saw him coming down the pipe, and that probably did more to destroy labor than Reagan and Bush combined. And that's what really scares me. And then, coupled with these so-called media polls that, you know, the mainstream media puts out, then they're clear to say, well, by the way, Iowa and New Hampshire are often very, very different from what, you know, the election actually comes out to be. It's sort of, you know, man, it's just a little paranoid, but it really scares me. She's a neocon. She's a hawk.
Yeah, well,
and I think if you believe that the media reflects public opinion, it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And that's the point that I've been making, is that the national polls are, frankly, I don't even think they're opinion polls. I think they're name recognition polls. And the more attention a candidate gets, the higher their name recognition goes, and the more likely when a pollster calls and says, will you vote for somebody? Yes, I think I'd vote for that person that I've been hearing their name on TV a lot. And that's what you end up with. But Jeremy, you know, thank you for your call and your comments. I will not call Hillary Clinton a neocon. I'm sorry. I'm just not going to go. In my opinion, she's not. She is a let's call it a conservative Democrat, a middle of the road Democrat, something like that. And I continue to hope and believe that it's possible that she could become progressive in her positions and surround herself with progressives. Bill Clinton, this is the lesson that I hope is learned by the Clinton campaign, particularly if she ends up the nominee. And I say this by qualifying it that she's not my first choice. And I believe that she's the woman that the Republicans want to run against, and the guy that they're most afraid of is John Edwards. Having said that, I'm sorry, that thought just ran right out my brain as somebody ran through the studio. Dan in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I think Jeremy's right on there with a lot of his comments. I think Hillary's a neocon herself. But I was interested in knowing how much you think the Iraq war is going to play in deciding the presidential election.
A lot. I think the Iran invasion is going to be the bigger variable. And it's an absolute wild card. If these guys have a, you know, like Israel bombing Syria a few months ago, if they have that kind of surgical strike and Iran doesn't freak out, And it seems to be a successful thing. If it can be like Reagan and Grenada, if it could be like Maggie Thatcher and the Falkland Islands, a minor small war. Maggie Thatcher hit like 92% popularity rating after. I mean, it just went right through the roof. And if they can pull something like that off, which is what I think they can do, and I think that they think that that's their plan, it's going to give a huge boost to the Republicans and that's, I think, why the Republican candidates are all doing saber rattling. Basically, that plus the fact that they've got nothing else. And so, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. I'm very concerned about it, though, and I think that we need to be speaking out more. Jim in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Jim.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
The reason I'm calling is basically, well, there's more than enough blame to go around to the Republican Party and the media and everything else. We eventually have to blame the American people for what's going on here. Are you there, Tom?
I am. Are you speaking as a Canadian or as an American, Jim?
I'm a dual citizen. I actually, when Bush was elected, within 2 years, I sold my house in Seattle, and I started buying property like crazy in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Why? Because I warned all my clients. I'm a CPA. I warned all my clients the day that he got elected, get your money out of the United States and get it out now.
Yeah. And if you put your money into Canadian dollars when Bush became president, right now it would be worth what, about 35% more than it was then?
Almost 50. The dollar,
almost
when
50.
When I told my people to do this, the Canadian dollar was at 59 cents. It's now at $1.07.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's well over 40%. And that's actually what we should be comparing our drop to, because the Canadians are our major trading partner, bar none.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
But the thing was, I've got a three-year-old son. I couldn't rely on the American education system anymore. I couldn't rely on anything anymore. And all I kept hearing from Americans was, cut my taxes, cut my taxes, cut my taxes.
Right.
I didn't hear anything else from them.
No, it's the insanity of Reagan. I mean, he so implanted this meme in people's minds, and they are so stuck to it, and it is so destructive to the United States. We had this incredible middle class built during the 40 years of the New Deal, and with a 91%, and then Kennedy took it down to 71%, but still a fairly high tax rate for people who made over $3.2 million a year in today's dollars. And Reagan kicked the bottom of that out by saying, no, the millionaires and billionaires, they're going to pay less than, frankly, working people pay right now in income taxes. And then Bush comes along and says, oh, not only that, but if you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check, you pay a maximum 15% income tax.
But
I mean,
Tom,
this is nuts.
But, Tom, there's a saying that says people get the government they deserve.
Yeah,
we
tragically.
We got the government we deserved, okay? I mean, look at who we picked. Last year there was a contest as favorite American. We picked Ronald Reagan.
Who's we?
Ronald Reagan.
Who's we?
Well, there was a national poll that was done. It was actually being done in about 10 or 12 different countries, and they were actually running programs on television about it, about yeah. who's your favorite American. Up here, yeah. they had who's your favorite Canadian. Up here, they picked Terry Fox, the guy with one leg that tried to run across the country for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Down there, what did we pick? We picked Ronald Reagan.
I know. I mean, what you're seeing here is the coup of the elites, the triumph of wealth and power, and inherited wealth and corporate wealth. And what has happened is that they rose up in 1980, and I believe through a criminal conspiracy that was engaged in by Bill Casey, who was running Ronald Reagan's campaign and was later the director of the CIA, and the day that he was going to testify before the House of Representatives, he said truthfully to the fact that he had cut a deal with the Iranians, according to his lawyer Milton Gould. That day, he had a seizure and was taken to the hospital, and the part of his brain responsible for speech was removed. I mean, they literally cut out a good chunk of his left temporal lobe, and by brain surgery, cut his tongue out, and he died about 6 weeks later as complications of the surgery. I mean, that was the beginning of it, in my opinion. That was the first coup, and then the second coup, and it's been coups. These have not been the American people selecting this. The second coup was in 2000, when the people of Florida voted, and when the recount was done 14 months later, the numbers were published in the New York Times. The people of Florida voted for Al Gore, and the Supreme Court said, "No, you will not count that vote."
Where were the riots? Where were the mass demonstrations to have this to overturn this? The American people gave him enough votes that we lied over and rolled over like a dog for him.
Yeah.
Now, the thing was, okay, sooner or later, if we really want change, we've got to look into each and every individual heart. And the only way that we can do that is to put the blame squarely where it belongs, on an American electorate that all they cared about was tax cuts.
Jim, I'm not disagreeing with you. And I'm telling you, we're not going to get anywhere if we sit around talking about who's how bad. You know, how bad am I? It's like, you know, we just, I'm not going to go down that road. I mean, it's like the old story, Paramahansa Yogananda used to tell the story about it. It's two guys walking down a road, an old dirt road, and there's a ripple in the road, and they both tripped and fell into the dirt. And one guy stands up and brushes himself off and keeps walking, and the other guy reaches over to the side of the road and grabs a stick and starts hitting himself over the head going, "Oh, I'm so stupid, I can't believe I fell in the road. What an idiot am I?" I mean, which are we going to be? Which one of those two guys are we going to be? What are we going to do? Kevin in Portland. Hey, Kevin, we got about half a minute here before we got to take a break. It's a quick one.
Well, first, I would like to send out kudos to you and for your oil segment earlier, and Kucinich for introducing the impeachment of Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
And oil and other corrupt forces, I think, are the main problem here. And thanks for pointing that out. I also wanted to mention that related to the oil issue, and you mentioned Carter making things more efficient. He actually made the country 30% more efficient, which was a big investment, and it paid dividends during Reagan's economy. Basically, mm-hmm. about a $1 billion boost, kind of like, you know, the first day of his office or something. So it helped him a lot. Carter doesn't get credit for that very often. The other thing is, as mentioning Hillary Clinton, her husband is a political, very politically savvy. And I would expect her to follow the power, including we the people, as long as we still have any kind of relevance.
Yeah, well, see, that's my hope, Kevin, and I think that you're right, and I think that, you know, Bill Clinton, to some extent, actually was doing what the majority of the people wanted, even if perhaps they were deluded, and I hope that Hillary can do the same, if she's there.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I miss.
Thank you.
It just don't get any better than
this. In all of this, Vice President Richard B. Cheney has acted in a manner contrary to his trust as Vice President and subversive of constitutional government, to the prejudice of the cause of law and justice, and the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, Richard B. Cheney, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office. Mr. Speaker.
Dennis Kucinich. And now, we find out who has declared that they're going to stop this from going forward. So you want to know who to call. Steny Hoyer, the Democrat from Maryland. U.S. This is from the Wall Street Journal, the Dow Jones News Service. U.S. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, Democrat from Maryland, said Tuesday, that would be today, he will block an effort to impeach Vice President Dick Cheney. Hoyer said he will use parliamentary tactics to table that effort. Quote, impeachment is not on the agenda, end quote, Hoyer said. Hoyer said his decision was not based upon the merits of the impeachment effort, but rather because the new Democratic majority had more important issues to resolve. Yeah. So if you think that Kucinich is right and that Dick Cheney should be impeached, go to callcongress.org and you can get the phone numbers for Congress, 202-225-3121, of course, the main number, but all the toll-free numbers are over there as well. And let Steny Hoyer know what you think about it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dean in L.A. Hey, Dean, what's on your mind?
I'm overwhelmed by that gentleman that calls, that now lives in Canada, that calls up and says that we're to blame for this.
Yeah,
yet
me too.
When it came to him, he fled the country.
Yeah, well, he actually, I mean, you know, the guy is a dual national, and he was using a lot of oots and a boots, and so I'm guessing he probably grew up in Canada. But, yeah, that's why I said, I'm sorry. I'm not going to sit around and kick myself or kick my fellow citizens for where we are right now. I will acknowledge that we share responsibility for it. But what we have to do right now is get active and move forward. We need to be looking at the future, not the past.
He could have been the one voice that shifted something. He could have changed someone's opinion, and they would have moved something.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're going to do. You don't know what you can affect. And moving to Canada and rooting for the Canucks ain't going to help us down here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dean. Kyle in San Rafael, California. Hey, Kyle.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling in praise of Dennis Kucinich. I think today we saw a profiles in courage moment. Anybody who saw his reading, very dramatic on C-SPAN, we can't help but be impressed. I put him in the same rank now as I would put Barbara Lee, who of course stood up, alone in the House of Representatives, to vote against the Iraq war resolution. And I would also put him in the same rank as Senator Feingold, who was the sole vote against the Patriot Act in the Senate. Today, this is history. And by the way, it is still being, the resolution is still being read live on C-SPAN for those of your listeners. And you're absolutely right to focus the heat on Steny Hoyer. That is where we have got to concentrate our phone calls, along with Nancy Pelosi. You talked about being active. Do it right now. Make that call. And also, I wanted to say, we should not forget to call the offices of Representative Kucinich and back him. And say, because I'm sure they're getting their share of nutcase calls. They need to be compensated for that and spend a little extra time making sure that the offices Congressman Kucinich are compensated with some good vibes.
Thank
you so much for bringing this up.
You're welcome, Kyle, and thanks a lot for the call. And in fact, you know, the best way, I think most of us, if you've got 5, 10, 15 bucks in a credit card, or 20 or 25 or whatever you know feel is appropriate, you can go to Kucinich.us and just give Dennis a donation. There are some who will cynically say, oh, this was a campaign stunt. Dennis is trying to get some publicity. But I'd say he's been on this thing for a long time. And I think this is being done out of integrity. Donna in Phoenix, Arizona, where I will be on Friday. Hey, Donna.
Hi, how are you?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I was calling because of this Kucinich bill that's coming up today on the floor, H.R. 333.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to let people know that, yeah, it's happening. But I also wanted to ask you what you thought of the possibility of going after Cheney and Bush after they're out of office. I mean, is there any civil suit? If Congress is not going to do what we want them to do, why can't Americans just get together on a suit against Cheney and Bush? I'd like to see them accountable. I mean, I don't think any leader should have the kind of executive privilege that they've demonstrated.
Yeah, Donna, I suspect that there's going to be a fair amount of that coming down the road. You know, hopefully We'll see. Dennis Kucinich has said, in his opinion, that the next president of the United States, he hopes it's him, the next president of the United States' first job, as soon as they take over the White House, should be to turn Cheney and Bush and their cronies over to the Justice Department for prosecution. I do not disagree. Anne in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Anne.
Yeah, hi. I'm going to start with my conclusion because I've been holding for a couple of hours.
Okay, and we only have about a minute before we've got to wrap up the show.
Well, as a legatee of the Christian West, we're starting to kill Muslims with the same indifference as we kill Jews. I don't call what's happening today a conservative philosophy. These people are provoking hatred and fear so they can deploy their strong suit, which is annihilation by bombing and chaos. And that's in the same bed as Nazism. Dorothy Thompson got it right about the Nazis. They turned on Western civilization, their own civilization. And that's what's happening with waterboarding. Just talk on waterboarding. We are turning on Western civilization today.
And very well said. Thank you very much for saying it. And let's not forget profit. There's a lot of profit in there as well. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be debating Terrence Jeffrey. Is Portland, Maine violating the law by giving middle school children birth control? Jennifer Ackerman here on her book Sex, Sleep, Eat, Drink, Dream, and Aaron Varhol about bankruptcy. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Go to callcongress.org, get a phone number, and let Steny Hoyer know and the other members of Congress, your member of Congress, what you think about Dennis Kucinich's impeach Cheney resolution. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.